Talk given Friday, 26th November, 1976. At our last group weekend, we dealt with something of fundamental importance. In a sense, it was as if the last words had been said that could be said. Those who were here may recall that we dealt with the meaning of true meditation and, incidentally, its purpose and significance. It is so important that it would be more than worth our while to consider together this same subject. Not only consider together, but discuss together. So whilst I'm talking, I want you to interrupt, ask questions, say something, and so on. Let me very briefly recapitulate the essential points. We distinguished between the brain and its function and activity from the mind. The term mind stands for the whole reality. The brain is only a part of it. The mind in itself is utterly pure and unconditioned. It is the brain, the physical instrument of the mind, that holds all the conditioning that we go through. The mind is everlastingly still and silent, using those words still and silent from the point of view of the brain looking at mind. The brain is the constant talker, the constant active from our conditioned point of view. This physical brain is the indispensable apparatus for the mind. This has to be borne carefully remembered. The brain cannot be emptied of its conditioning either by wishing it or by any sort of specialized technique to empty the brain. It cannot be done. This is one of the very important and very difficult points in this connection. If the brain were totally emptied, our existence here, minus the conditioned brain, would be one which was completely outside our control. We couldn't live physically. There has to be conditioning so that the body knows the different ways in which to move, to act, and so on in various situations. So the brain holds a very large store of material conditioning, meaning thereby the conditioning which is concerned with the routine of daily life and activity, with the different material skills, professional, domestic, or whatever they are, with the accumulation of knowledge of all the ordinary know-hows of daily life. This the brain has to have. But the psychological conditioning is the conditioning from which it has to find release. If it is released from its psychological conditioning, then the brain is in a state of stillness. Of silence. Then the mind functions freely through the living person. And as and when this immeasurable total reality, this transcendent reality, the mind, functions in this way, the brain remains still and silent and is the instrument through which the person watches. But his watching is free of the separating consciousness of subject and object. The I as an observer is out of the picture. There is observing, there is watching, there is seeing. But that which is seeing is the pure activity of the mind. And being the pure activity of the mind, there is no interpretation in any of our material, limited, conditioned terms of that which is being seen. This is the meaning of meditation. You can't bring it about. You can't order it. You can't say, I, the person, am now going to meditate. For the simple reason that this activity of the mind is an activity belonging to a dimension of being and consciousness which utterly transcends everything that is represented by the living human organism. body, feelings, thoughts, conceptions, beliefs, ideas, the whole lot. And this is a real meaning, an actual meaning of what the mystics say when they declare that before the soul can stand in the presence of God, it must be utterly naked. Now, it's all very well for me to just say these words. They may be meaningless to you, or they may inspire you, or meet with your approval or disapproval or whatever it is. But our task really is to understand this carefully. And to understand means, first and foremost, not to interpret by the brain, howsoever knowledgeable it may be. Understanding is intimately bound up with insight. The two can practically be interchanged. And this insight is an activity which is utterly formless, shapeless. It has no limitations, no dimensions to it, no conditions attached to it. It is an activity which is union itself. There are no words. This union is a nondescript reality. So you see, what meditation means. I'm using the English word meditation for the Sanskrit samadhi, the Hindu Buddhist samadhi, for the mystical unio mystica, the real unio mystica. When you find the mystics interpreting too much, their experiences of the consolations that they received from God. And they generally call God love itself, you see. Be sure that this is not the real thing. This is the play of imagination. There is still this separated I in relationship to not God in his godness, the Godhead, but the projection out of the mind of the mystic. One is playing with oneself psychologically. Let us discuss this together. First and foremost, there is not anything special to discuss. The I consciousness persists by excluding the rest of the universe. Otherwise, there cannot be an I consciousness. You will just be aware. There will be pure awareness which will include yourself completely and utterly. You see?
All right.
That kind of awareness is the absolute divine awareness. The manner in which the Aseka, the liberated Holy One, a Buddha, an Arahant, is aware. So the I consciousness subsists by excluding the rest of the universe. That we fully, clearly understand. I mean, all of us here do sort of appreciate that. Now, let us come to this business of the quiet brain, because this is where all the doings come in. Tell me, if the brain is quiet, is really quiet, who is it that sees or hears? That will imply, will it or not, or will it not, the fact that the self-consciousness is not obtruding itself. You are not aware in terms of I am seeing. What sort of a seeing will it be in that case?
A physical reflection of what is in front of you. A physical view rather than a perception. In other words, what you see is reflected in your vision as a physical thing. It's not as opposed to a mental view, because if the brain is empty and the brain is not aware that it is seeing something, but the mind is aware, then it's a mental perception which has implanted itself upon the mind and therefore does not interfere with the actual mental brain operation at that moment of impact.
But look, when you're looking at a chair, say, I'm suggesting chair because we are sitting in a room. If we were outside, one might say a cloud or a tree or whatever it is. When you're looking at a chair, are you aware it's a chair? If the brain is quiet?
There is no name given.
You become aware of if you're looking properly. If you're looking properly in the quiet mind, the first thing is that the colour of the chair is brighter and clearer, and then the life of the chair.
Would you recognize that color?
Yes. What you would recognize about everything is the life in the chair. That is what, as it were, speaks to you.
There's no name given. There's no interpretation.
Yes.
The color is seen but not named.
Yes.
But would you know?
No.
Afterwards you would say that is brown, but when you see it, you just see it.
All right, we've mentioned color. What about shape?
Shape
See, after all, there are rays of light reflected from the chair, and there is the physical mechanism going on, the light rays and the effect on the cells of the brain at the back of the head.
One can only speak with this quiet from the quietness of the mind one has known, and the chair remains chair, but moves. the chair lives. The mind is quiet enough. It remains in form chair, but not just chair. It is a living chair.
Will there be thoughts about it?
Not while you are simply looking at chair, if you are being sufficiently quiet. If there are thoughts about it, then you are no longer in that state.
I think I see a very fine distinction between the position you pose here. Now, if the brain is empty,
quiet.
Quiet. And the chair is before one, and one is looking. The brain does not operate as a means of determining what is before one's view. So therefore, the brain does not come into the perception at all. The brain is inactive.
It doesn't come into the act of perception.
No, the brain is empty. Therefore, whatever forces of recognition take place, whatever forces of recognition take place, must be a mind force. Force of the mind.
All right, go on.
So if there's a force of the mind, then I would assume that it means inevitably that a viewing, as you put it a little while ago, is occurring. A seeing is occurring without its establishing itself upon the mental processes as indicating a particular form definition or distinction as to what it is.
And producing reactions.
Producing a non-reaction, because the reaction of the mind is something that is part of the deeper self and not a mechanistic part of the body, such as the brain or the hand or the...
Wait a minute, you said deeper self.
Well, the id, if you like, the self, the being, whatever one calls that. Yeah, I'm trying to make the distinction between the operation of the brain as a physical thing and the function of the mind as something beyond the brain. Something outside of the brain function.
It is not outside, but over and above. And the brain is quiet inside this, the brain being a part. Is it your mind?
No. It is universal mind at that stage. I would suppose. Because at that stage you don't possess anything. Nothing is owned or in lieu of or what have you. It's just a factor of the universal aspect of things as they are at that time of the viewing.
In such seeing, which will also apply to hearing, touching, smelling, etc., in such seeing, can desire be present? If desire was present, you wouldn't know?
No, you're at that stage, you are just looking or listening. There is nothing else. You are aware there is a chair, But no more than that.
So you would say that there is no desire present?
I would say there is no desire present, yes.
And that would imply, would it or would it not, that there is neither attachment nor aversion present?
Yes, yes.
And if there is neither attachment nor aversion present, then the living person is in a state of complete freedom.
Even that is not known.
Yes. There is no sense of I am free, in other words. The freedom is a reality.
One says, I suppose so, one may say yes afterwards.
All right. Good. In that state, there is an understanding of the chair which there was never present, never can be present if the brain isn't quiet. What does this understanding do? It's one word to suggest the energy of supreme mind, of total mind. What does this understanding do?
It unites.
Gives you light.
It unites.
It unites.
Mm-hmm.
What else does it do?
It takes you out. It stops you. It stops you fearless from maybe pushing yourself forward all the time. There could be a tendency to step back and stay in the foreground rather than bustle towards the front.
Well, it is chair.
There's something very important which understanding does, which may come as a shock to all of us.
The suchness of chair is known then. The suchness of chair is known.
Known?
Well, in this situation, chair is living. There is this uniting point. This if there is anything, there is the cognition of chair.
Supposing I were to say that one of the consequences of such understanding is destruction.
Yes.
Destruction of what? That is so, quite generally speaking. But
destruction of attitudes to chair.
Yes.
One thinks no longer of chair as something to sit on. One is more inclined to nod to chair, knowing deeply within oneself
the chair is.
The destruction of connotations of chair are gone.
What is the implication of this with respect to the brain now? It's a very important point.
The implications are known in memory.
No, something happens at once.
Well, two things happen at once. One is chair is seen. The other thing is that while the brain is quiet, it is as though information beyond words is passed between the two, and this has to be sorted out in memory.
Look, once again, consider this word destruction.
Yes.
This transcendent power functioning through the quiet brain, there is the state of understanding, and there is a destruction.
Oh, yes.
Brain loses all preconceived ideas because it knows.
That's it. The conditioning is destroyed. Now, I used the word destroyed. It's not really my word. I wanted to make it a bit dramatic, so I used the word destroyed. But the word destruction is very much associated with the idea of annihilation in our awareness, in our consciousness.
This is why they say you never see the same chair again.
So there is no annihilation of the conditioning of the brain. What's happened?
Conversion.
Hmm?
A conversion.
Yes.
There are the two levels in the understanding of chair.
No. All that brings you back into the realm of limitation.
Oh, yes, it does. But once you're... This is not a permanent state, at least not for me.
One is released from the conditioning because the expression, the mode in which that conditioning manifests is a tying up of energy, is a constricting of energy. The energy is released altogether. Just like in the stars, these terrific atomic explosions continuously take place. The atom is energy constricted. And with the explosion, the energy gets released as light and heat. We have in our physical existence, in this physical universe, a wonderful manifestation of what happens psychologically. This is as far as I can put it into words, the profoundest meaning of the purification of the psyche, the purification of the mind. We talk of purification of the mind, but I would prefer, mind you, this is just a personal preference, because the word psyche has a limited meaning. You have a psyche individually, simply because your brain and ductus glands and blood and everything determine that psyche. And the functioning of the organism determines it. The psyche is rooted in the physical organism. Mind is a word which we may better reserve for the total reality. As in fact, certainly in Hindu-Buddhist teaching, it has done. Krishnamurti does the same. You see? So now, there is no destruction in the sense of annihilation. But there is this utter transformation, this transmutation, almost, of the constricted state of energy, pure energy, which we denote by the word mind in this case. The word energy here must not be understood in the exclusively in the sense in which the scientist uses the word energy. By energy he means that which is manifested as electricity, magnetism, heat, light, etc. Not just that alone. All that, of course, gets included, if you like. But science hasn't exhausted the knowledge of the nature of energy or its manifestations. So there is this energy which has now become free of its constriction. And if it has become free of its constrictions, then the whole problem of ambivalent good and evil and the conflict is completely out. It means that conflict is completely out of the psyche. The psyche is the region of conflict. Mind seeing through the quiet and still brain . So you see, the essential condition is this quiet and still brain. Not the brain which you have started to polish and scrub and sweep clean or hoover it of its conditioning, its drawbacks, its particular ideas and beliefs and the whole caboodle. You haven't done that. You can do that for the next million years and get no forwarder. You'll only be manufacturing new beliefs, new ideas and so forth. Now you see, all this has a tremendous bearing upon what is commonly called the practice of meditation. The crucial point then is this quiet and still brain. But we look at ourselves and immediately we can say, quite truthfully, our brains are not quiet and still. How does the quietness and the stillness of the brain come about? How could it come about? Now please note, how could it come about, not be brought about? Why not?
It's all the time you're doing it, you're doing it.
No, all the time
you're deliberately trying to quieten the brain, you are telling it to be quiet, and that telling itself is movement.
Who is the teller?
This thing.
The desirous self. And that, therefore, it defeats the whole thing. Because this is I wanting to do this. I cannot want in relation to the transcendent. It is because I want in relation to the transcendent. Therefore, God is compelled to just keep looking and waiting and waiting and waiting. I imprison God in time. I never allow God's eternity to release me. So you see, it cannot be brought about. But it could come about. Now, how can it come about? This is something which can be done within the sphere of limitation.
Watch. You have to let go.
Yes. That is an essential aspect of right watching. Let go. That means no grasping at what you watch. You see, when we enter upon the religious life in depth, all sorts of tremendous things come up like this. Because you see, the watcher, when we start, is the brain. The I concretized, firmly established, is watching to start with. And you see, this watcher cannot watch without choice, without taking sides. It cannot. Because that part of our conscious mind, conscious brain, which knows that it is watching, will quarrel with itself the moment it sees the manifestation of selfness coming in. So there'll be conflict. But the whole point about the quiet brain is that it is free from conflict. And it is really the unconscious activity of this brain, the thing that you can't see, the hidden activity, which is all the time itching to bring about a result because it is associated with this terrific conditioning, not merely within one's lifetime, but from the very beginning when man became man, that to do good, to find fulfillment, is a supreme happiness. Grasping all the time. The tentacles of humanity stretch out almost to the heavens. Now you see, we've really got to awake to this. So the brain cannot be without choice. Therefore, it cannot be without conflict. But then you will say then, but then how on earth is there any release taking place? This is where the great mystery takes place. Just remain aware that I am in a state of constriction. Don't try to get rid of it. Don't do anything about it. Don't pronounce any judgments on it. Don't say good, bad, or anything. Just be with it. Just be with it. Aware of it. The intensity of the awareness dissolves the constriction. You will find it very, very difficult to do in everyday life. Here and now, let us say, here and now, somehow, one experiences the tremendous inspiration of it, and lo and behold, the brain is quiet and silent and we are selfless and all the rest of it. for a few seconds, for a few minutes. But it doesn't last. The moment we go out, the moment we get occupied, you see, all the demons of hell are out. They are having a procession which has neither beginning nor end. It is so long. And it is so long for the simple reason that it is a round thing. It's not a straight line. It's a round thing. It goes round and round and round. When the self is active and uppermost, which it usually is, or when you pursue this self to discover the real self, it is always a circular motion, round and round. Here we go round the merry-go-round. And the round doesn't happen to be so merry. This is the round of suffering. So now, through the day and at night, when you wake up, if you wake up at night, I mean if you sleep from 9 in the evening till 6 in the morning and then out of bed, well, that's a different story. But if you do wake up during the night, just watch suddenly, awake to the fact when the body has awaked. Awake to the fact. The brain is not quiet. It is not still. Quiet and still brain. Just be awake to the fact. Intensely awake. And don't interfere with that awakeness. Just be with it. And then see what happens.
Is it because of that release of energy that when one has had an intense experience of looking, one sometimes feels completely exhausted afterwards?
No. Look, if the thing happens properly, you see, and rightly, it happens in the state of complete ease, and you are invigorated, not exhausted.
Well, forgive me, there is just a feeling of exhaustion, and invigoration follows very quickly after, but it is as though one has been completely cleaned from head to foot and is left panting, and then invigoration comes. Probably.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Conditioning had to go. I see what you mean.
Then it probably is getting rid of conditioning too.
Now you see, this process of being watchful, being awake, if it is carried out rightly, means that one becomes aware of the movement of every thought and feeling throughout the day. You are awake to it. You know this is happening all the time. This thought, that feeling is present. And if you follow that with full attention, which does not mean that you are concentrating attention in the sense of excluding other things. You are carrying on with the cooking, you are carrying on with your lecturing, your teaching, washing the children, whatever you may be doing, you see. All that goes on simultaneously, in the office, in the home, anywhere, everywhere, you see. But if you follow, very carefully follow every thought and every feeling, you will understand its origins in your own being. And you will find on the whole that every thought and every feeling, as we ordinarily experience throughout life, has deep roots in greed, fear, violence, hate, envy, jealousy, the whole bag. Deep roots. This is not to exclude what we commonly call good in the ambivalent sense. The opposites are also present, simultaneously. You see, the opposites enfold each other. The yin-yang symbol is a wonderful symbol to express this enclosure in the realm of manifestation. When we have really understood this, you see, we know, to use the common phrase, we know ourself. And in that kind of self-knowing is the ending of sorrow. The sorrow which is not merely pain physically, merely misery, unhappiness psychologically, not merely that, but the sorrow which goes very, very deep. That is the ending of sorrow. And it is an ending of sorrow because we have grown free of both attachment and aversion to the inevitable pain and psychological suffering that comes through sympathy and understanding of the pain and suffering everywhere. We have become free of both attachment and aversion to those two aspects. And it is that sorrow alone which the living man can free himself from, can become free of. So the brain becomes quiet and still. The brain knows quietness and stillness whilst it is still fully active in the ordinary way through everyday life. And this is the meaning of meditation. This is the actual state of meditation. Now you'll see the implication of this. All selfness, all desiring is really completely out. And it is out because the transformation in your own psyche has taken place. Not because I have driven it out or cleaned up the psyche. Not at all. Because I can never do that. These are illusions. See, that is why, despite the good intentions of people the world over, with all these societies and groups and so on, oh, practice this and do that, and you will get such and such a good result, such and such a desirable result. Now, if I am going to get hellfire and damnation as a result, am I going to follow that technique? No, because I have this silly little preconception that I should avoid hellfire and damnation. But I'm constantly suffering hellfire and damnation every day. See how difficult is the religious life. But when the change takes place, suddenly this thing which was dross is glittering gold. And you say, oh, how wonderful, how marvelous, it happened. Hosanna in the highest. One of the deep significances of Christmas. One of the deep significances of the birth of a bodhisattva. Of a Brahmaputra, of a true man.